Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Ann Patchett. She's the author of Bel Canto, the most recent of her novels. It's published by HarperCollins. Her previous books include The Magician's Assistant, Taft, and The Patron Saint of Liars, in reverse order. And one of the things I like most about her novels is that they seem to be about ways in which families get reinvented or rebuilt, reshaped, reoriented. And I wanted to begin immediately, almost, by asking you how that came to be such a persistent concern.
It's the thing that's always interested me. I have a lot of people who will say that my books seem to have been written by four different people. And I always say, no, in fact, I just write the same book over and over again, and I probably always will.
Describe the book that you write over and over again.
A group of strangers are thrown together by circumstance and somehow form a family. That's my tagline. I could have it tattooed on my arm. And I think that that's probably half of Western literature. If that's my theme, I'm not going to get in too much of a rut, as long as I always find very, very different people and emotional circumstances for them to live in.
Now, it seems to me that there is also a certain Midsummer Night's Dream quality to the books that allow these reformations to occur. And what's more, it isn't the case that most of these characters, there's one or two exceptions, come from atrocious backgrounds that we've heard about that necessitate that as they make the trek from victim to survivor, that they change their family. No, it's a different thing entirely. These are sort of Forest of Arden romances, in a sense, in which people are given the opportunity to at least glimpse their heart's content in the course of shaping a new culture around them. And they seem like late Shakespearean romances.
Mm-hmm. What a wonderful thought that it would work that way. Now, I'm very bad at villains, and no one really does come from a great deal of suffering. There's a lot more of an internal life, I think, in these stories as they play out.
When you say that you're bad at villains, what in fact
terrible
do you mean? Why?
I don't know. I'm bad at a lot of things, but I think that whenever I get close to a character, I always wind up going soft on them. A book that really fascinates me is Paris Trout by Pete Dexter, because it's a completely villain-centered novel, and you get to know Paris Trout so well, and yet you continue to hate them. It's just relentless. But I find I'd be a terrible lawyer. Whenever I start to really look at a character, I always fall for them. So in this book that's full of terrorists, by the end, I love them all.
Well, it interests me because, in fact, Bel Canto, by my guest Ann Patchett, her most recent novel, published by HarperCollins, centers in a house, a very beautiful house, in fact. Why? We're told that the vice president, a man of the people, whose house this occurs in, has married a wealthy woman. But it's almost as if in this novel, a beautiful place, a kind of palatial estate, is necessary for what will go on there. It's almost as if from the very beginning of this book, what we find is that reality will be suspended for the sake of ideality. And that imagination is going to provide an escape that it doesn't usually provide in life. Now, since the book is about a set of terrorists who take hostage an entire party, and there is only one accidental death in this novel, a death by a diabetic, you must have made a certain kind of decision in writing about terrorists that what we mean when we say terrorists will not be what we usually mean when we say terrorists.
I think that's true. And, of course, there are ultimately a lot more deaths in the book. This book, in a sense, comes out of the reviews of my first three books. I thought I had written three very realistic books. This is only a part of the story. But every time I read a review of any of my first three novels, the very good reviews or the very bad reviews said exactly the same thing. These books are very magical. These books take place out of time. These books, just what you're saying, the fantastical, they don't exist in the world. And I thought, God, I really thought that I was writing these books that were very much grounded in reality. So if I'm doing this thing that I don't really seem to see in myself, then I want to push it and go all the way with it. So I'll write a book that to me does seem fantastical, isn't anywhere in reality. And I thought the best place to start that would be with a real story. So it would give me a good jumping off point.
Now, that means in turn that disbelief has to be, in fact, not only willingly suspended, but willfully suspended, because as we meet these terrorists who, on the occasion of a birthday of a Japanese business executive who has been invited to the hosting country, as it's called repeatedly, an opera singer who the executive loves has been invited. The executive, it is hoped by the president of the country, will build a plant in the country, and they've used the opera singer, who they're paying elaborately, essentially as bait to bring the executive there. But as we meet these terrorists, in fact, the younger ones are immensely and deeply talented. One of them turns out to have a voice that the opera singer believes could be the new voice of the world.
Yes.
One of them turns out to be a very diligent and sensitive chess player.
Yes.
Another is about essentially to be the most graceful of child brides if it were not for the suspension of her life. In other words, what we're being asked to fantasize here is that everyone has on their other side an incipient genius within.
Why not? And also all of the businessmen who are stuck there, who have led classically type A busy lives in which they've never stopped to appreciate anything, turn out to be capable of great appreciation and great love of beauty. It's about the redemptive power of art. And yes, if we could take everyone outside of society and put them in a completely calm utopian environment, would they bloom? If you take every little weed and you put it in a hothouse, will they become an orchid?
Now, if I remember correctly, I remember reading that your father is a law enforcement person, yes?
Retired, yes.
Yes. So I'm curious about what leads you. You expect the children of people involved in the law in various ways to start writing thrillers. And often they do. How? What would you say gave birth to this sensibility?
Not my parents' professions. My mother was a nurse, and I think of both of my parents as extremely civic and extremely helpful and compassionate people, very, very good people. But I don't know if that's connected to my writing and what is in my personality, a profound sense of oblivion about the world around me that I've had ever since I was a child. I never really cared what people thought, and I always just quietly went off and did what I wanted to do. And the fact that I wasn't going to fit in, be like other kids, make my living in the same way, never struck me as strange. And there are times that I've really wondered if my brain is simply wired up in a different way, that it didn't bother me. I'm capable of being alone for long periods of time. In fact, incapable of being with people for long periods of time. Just a very quiet person who lives in her head. And so making up stories seem like a really reasonable career. But the bottom line is things that seem fantastical to other people don't seem fantastical to me. I also wondered if that has to do with growing up Catholic, a religion of miracles and saints and sacrifice and all of that, where the fantastical is real. That's a very good ground to grow up on for a novelist.
I'm speaking to Ann Patchett, the author most recently of Bel Canto, and you're listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Do you consider yourself a Catholic writer?
No, I consider myself a Catholic and I consider myself a writer. I don't consider myself a Catholic writer.
Because, you know, Graham Greene and Flannery O'Connor both did consider themselves Catholic writers. And they wanted, it was very of great concern to them, in fact. Many letters of Flannery O'Connor's say that Catholics are so concerned with issues of redemption that they've let the art suffer. That the books are not good enough, and that her job as a Catholic was to be a good writer.
And absolutely wonderful. If I could manage that, what a privilege that would be. But for me, Catholicism is completely permeated my being. I don't even think about it. It's just what I am, and I'm sure that it comes out of my writing, informs my writing all of the time. I don't ever sit down and think, now I have to carry the banner of being a Catholic writer.
Now, when you introduce the themes of music, which are central, really, to this book, this
yes.
whole book is orchestrated around arias and songs and scenes of recognition and potential betrayal and scenes of initiation, the scenes that operas specialize in.
Right.
Does your interest in the music begin with liturgical music?
No. My interest in the music for this book began in watching the story on the news and thinking, this is an opera. I'm watching an operatic story, and if I got to write this story, there would be an opera singer there. That isn't connected with Catholicism at all. Also, bringing Mr. Hosokawa in from somebody who loves opera and doesn't have enough time for it to somebody who suddenly has endless time for it, and then he becomes basically a character in an opera. He goes through the looking glass and enters into the world of opera. I wanted to write a book that was structured like an opera.
The tone here is very punkish. The author wants to let readers know from the very opening pages that this is not a book in which people are going to get wounded and shoved around, that even when a character bleeds, the blood wants to make its way back into the head through the ear. There's a level of amusement about the situation that says, I am writing a romantic comedy about this situation. The actualities of the situation may concern you, but they do not me.
Yes.
Why do you work that way? I mean, because you are contradicting a good deal of reality when you do so.
Because again, that's probably the way my brain is wired. But also, if you're going to be talking about the redemptive power of art, if art is going to be the thing that sets these people free, that gives them joy that they've never had before, why not set up a stage that would be higher stakes, in a sense? It would have to come from a way that wouldn't be readily expected. And it's not like I sat down and thought, let me construct a way. There'll be a huge dichotomy between what we think is going to happen, what would happen in real life, and what actually happens in the novel. But when I think I want people to be rescued by art, I want them to have a glory in their life, a period of utopian glory. So just the idea, the way you would in an opera, to bump everything up to a higher level, well, seems sensible.
Just to be contrary, though.
Please.
The image most of the time that would get invoked that would pit art against terroristic circumstance is the image of the string quartets being played in the concentration camps. Mm-hmm. And there is, to some extent, an awareness that this is not an image of art rescuing people, but that people's natures of a certain kind assert themselves despite their access to high culture. And there is a certain astonishment, I think, that a reader has to feel when people who have managed to arm themselves and enter a building via its air conditioner ducts, who are, after all, carrying guns, not magic wands, mm-hmm. Are now falling captive to the charms of a great opera singer. We know in general that this hasn't been the case, that civilization doesn't usually win in circumstances like this.
But this is not only a novel, this is my novel, and it's about creating a universe. And when you create a universe in a book, what matters, I think, is that you're honest and that you're consistent. And so, yes, I'm setting up a completely different set of rules that don't go along with the rules of reality. That doesn't bother me at all. All that matters to me is that I follow through. So this is a world outside of a world we know. These are the things that happen in my world.
Is the writing fraught with concern? Can I make this world convincing, this world which I would desperately love to live in? Or are you able to put aside the concerns of the real world and enter the fantasy place enough that the unlikelihoods don't distract you?
The unlikelihoods never distracted me for a minute. And maybe this takes us back to Catholicism. What I wanted to be when I was a child was God.
Is that true?
That is true. Uh-huh. That is true. I mean, why not aspire to the top position? I used to say that I wanted to be a saint, but that really wasn't true. I wanted to be God. And this is the job. This is the job for any child who wants to grow up and be God. I am the costume designer. I create people in my own image. Which character is me? They're all me. they're all different ways in which I play out things I want to be, things I wish I had, things I want to think about more. I make the sets. I make the weather. I keep people alive and I kill them. And again, in any universe, there are a set of laws that keep things afloat. So do I think at all, well, you know, this isn't going along with the set of rules in the normal universe. This isn't the way things normally go. It doesn't make any difference. As long as you walk with authority, as long as you create your own world, then it should be whichever world you want it to be. And I don't ever stop and hold it up against the world that I live in, because I live in my head, and that's anything I want it to be.
Have you found it easy to live in your head?
Sure, absolutely.
Really? Because many people don't.
Oh, no. I swear. And this is a very interesting interview, and I'm sounding more and more like an insane person as we go along.
No, there's two of us here.
Thank God. It's the only world I've ever lived in, this world, my world. And I believe very strongly that there are certain points to my life that I should try to be the best person I can be. I should try to be kind. I should try to live as some sort of an example. I do those things. I work hard at being as good and helpful in my life as I can be. But do I look at the club down the street where people are dancing at 2 o'clock in the morning and think, if only I could join in? never for a second. It wouldn't even occur to me. I just want to go to bed, get the dog, be by myself, get up, go back to writing in the morning.
I know the two people that I've become friendly with over the years were among your writing teachers. Those are Grace Paley and Russell Banks.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I guess I should ask you, did you feel close to them as teachers?
This was at Sarah Lawrence. My first teacher, because this is where it all starts, was Alan Gurganis. And I felt so extraordinarily close to Alan and still do feel so close. I'm not Alan's friend. I will always be Alan's student, and I will always worship him. I had similar feelings about Grace and Russell, but never as much, never as close. Alan is the most gifted and generous teacher that I think ever was.
Because it seems to me, it's very interesting, and it seems absolutely apt, because in Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, a father says to her daughter, "Reality, when will you look it in the face?" And there is a certain sense in which those stories are tiptoeing more and more dangerously to confrontations with the world that the character would not like to live in at all, that the world is changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that her belief in enormous changes at the last minute that can rescue everyone is becoming more and more threatened. With Russell Banks, you take a step further in a sense. There never was the possibility yeah. of rescue or escape.
Yes.
Things were bleak before you came onto the scene.
And they're only getting bleaker.
Yes. And so it seems to me that Gurganis is a good teacher for the kind of work that you do. But when you were confronted in writing workshops with people who must have shaken a finger at you and said, "Now, you know, we have a certain obligation to face the world head on with open eyes. We don't want to lie to people. We don't want to give them fantasy worlds to live in. It's dangerous to do that." Were you confronted in that way? No one.
No, and you know, I'm not writing science fiction.
No.
It's not too far outside of reality. In fact, what I like about it is I like to think that it sits right on the edge, right on the very line. It looks exactly like reality. It's just a little better. And I write literary fiction, and the genius of writing literary fiction is nobody cares at all what you're doing. I'm not John Grisham. They're not people banging on my door saying, "But we need another novel about lawyers." What I've discovered as I've gone on in this career, I have complete freedom in my life. I can write about anything I want, anything that pleases me. If it doesn't sell, if I don't make any money, I'll have to face those consequences. But I don't ever think about that when I'm writing. I only write maybe what I want to see. I write what interests me.
Now, it's very interesting to me that although, as the listener must have assumed, the tone here is not so much fanciful as idealistic, I think. You know,
okay.
this is what life should be. But the style is not the Gaga style of overwritten fairy story. It's a fairly humble Markin style. And I wondered how you developed it.
I have no idea. This is the way I write. It's sort of like saying, how did you develop that nice walk?
So you never developed a writing style consciously. Because
no.
some writers do.
No,
you know.
No. This is it. This is all I know how to do. But I know there are people who have influenced me, but I'm fairly pared down. There are writers that I love who haven't influenced me, who I wish would, like Nabokov. I wish I could write Lolita. I wish I could write with that incredibly complicated, florid, gorgeous insanity of language. I love that. I admire it so much. It's just not who I am. It's not what I do.
Now, the writer I thought of a lot when I read you and still think of is Isaac Dinesen.
How lovely.
Do you have any affiliations? Do you like her?
I love her. I actually didn't start reading her until about 2 years ago. And I was completely completely taken over by it. And love her language, love her style.
Well, it's also that sense of a moral fairy tale being constructed out of real situations that give way to idealized conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
And a fascinating sense that we are living in an unlikely moral ethical universe, that the stories, that the characters in these stories, however they'd be treated in a daily world, will be treated according to moral and aesthetic standards
mm-hmm.
within the story world. And what's sort of very enheartening in reading your work is to know now that I'm on the fourth novel, that even though, yes, there is a bloodbath at the end of Bel Canto, what has been offered by the book itself has been a glimpse of what one character calls a social experiment, but a successful social experiment. And I feel safe reading you. I've gone through four books now, and I know that although things are allowed to end badly, in some wonderful way, the good triumphs as better than the actual.
Yes, I hope so. I don't think that the point is to have a long life. I think the point is to have a beautiful life, to do something, to care deeply, to love. And how long you get to do it really is probably irrelevant.
Is there a difference between good and beauty in this world?
Yes, certainly. But I don't know if there is between good and beauty in my world.
Uh-huh. Beauty is good, good beauty?
If beauty is art, certainly not in terms of physical beauty. I mean, beauty in a standard way. But yes, I believe that art is good.
I've been speaking to Ann Patchett, the author most recently of Bel Canto, a novel about terrorists that turns into a novel about utopians. It's published by HarperCollins. Thank you very, very much for joining me.
Thank you. It's been fun.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.